it was almost the week where definitively nothing happened, but at the same time, China loomed large on all fronts. Welcome to the Exchange Invest Weekly. My name is Patrick L. Young. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief, it was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light, it was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope, it was the winter of despair. We had everything before us, we had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven, we were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received for good or for evil in the superlative degree of comparison only. Thus began Charles Dickens' magnificent historical novel, A Tale of Two Cities, written in 1859 about the period around about the Jacobin Reign of Terror. At the same time, it seems somewhat appropriate for financial market structure. My name is Patrick L. Young. Welcome to the Exchange Invest podcast. This is our weekly. We take a series of the key stories that have been in the news during the course of the week and give them to you with a little bit of added PLY pith. It's all taken from the Exchange Invest newsletter, which you can receive Monday through Friday, emailed to your inbox. And generally speaking, what we're going to talk about here is, well, everything related to bourses, exchanges, financial market structure, platforms, open markets, and indeed the whole underpinnings of capitalism, the modern-day financial commodity equity product base. When it comes to recognizing revolutionary reigns of terror, there are certainly a lot of things that one might be rather, well, perturbed by when it comes to the history of China over the course of the last 70 years. And in many ways, China dominated the leading headlines of the week. On the good and the bad side, it has to be said. On the good side, China is planning a huge futures market overhaul, and it looks to be a vast liberalisation. People are going to be able to get investing from overseas in lots of products that they weren't previously allowed access to. Admittedly, I have to say, I'm rather concerned about how many US investors are going to turn up to play, given the current, well, what might one call it, rather heated series of exchanges that are going on over trade protectionism and all manner of tariffs between China and Washington. At the same time, the worrying side was not within the trade war per se for the market structure, even though that was, in some ways, destabilizing markets during the course of the week. Rather, there was an incredible exclusive in the South China Morning Post, a leading newspaper of the time, which gives many, many interesting asides not generally seen in the Western media. Anyway, the story makes quite astounding reading in the South China Morning Post. Its headline, Shanghai's Bourse Asks Banks, Bondholders to Cut Debtors Some Slack to Ensure Financial Stability Through China's 70th Birthday. In this case, it's all about a meeting on August the 5th between creditors and bondholders, where the Shanghai Stock Exchange, no less, asked lenders to give the Hotai Motor Group until after the 1st of October to repay up to 1 billion yuan in owed payments. It's quite an astounding amount of money, actually. It's about, what, $50 billion US, roughly speaking. It was a five-year putable bond they had for 5 billion yuan, so $284 million in that case, which was issued in 2016. Apparently, the Shanghai Stock Exchange have asked for the put deadline to be put back after China's 70th anniversary National Day celebrations on October the 1st. Has to be said, I think a lot of parishioners are going to be somewhat uneasy at the idea that this could be going on and that therefore there could be some degree of official manipulation of credit events, which could lead us to, well, a very exciting fourth quarter after the celebrations have taken place. As the South China Morning Post article notes, the intervention by the exchange underscores the Chinese government's sensitivity to financial turbulence, particularly when the worst economic growth pace on record is raining on the Communist Party's commemoration of 7 decades in power. Equally, the article goes on to note that China's corporate bond defaults rose to a 4-month high in July, with 14 notes, no less, missing at least 14.4 billion yuan in repayments. That's a lot of money. That's getting on for $1 billion. However you look at this, I'm sure a great deal of parishioners are going to be concerned about what's going on in terms of the artificial maintenance of credit until the 70th anniversary takes place. Hopefully, there will be an orderly reorganization and restructuring thereafter. Meanwhile, of course, on the streets of Hong Kong, there's been some political unrest. It was interesting to see a personal view from a non-executive board member of Hong Kong Exchange. Unrest gives Hong Kong a chance to start afresh, was published by the Inkstone website during the course of the week. And of course, earlier in the week, we had the wonderful news. The Hong Kong Bourse, Hong Kong Exchanges, has agreed terms for dual-class share trading with mainland China. That sounds like a very, very exciting development indeed, which will allow the through trains of the Connect programmes to power ahead. So all in all, a fascinating but mixed week in China. TMX was the leader in the field with their record earnings numbers during the course of the last week. Tradeweb beat its earnings, revenue was meeting forecasts, but unfortunately they had a one-time expenses hit thanks to buying a huge amount of stock options on behalf of their staff through the IPO. At the same time, Virtu had their second quarter results, which seemed to disappoint the marketplace overall. I described it at the time as being, well, a few low latency antennae short of expectations. Don't get the joke, we'll understand that in just a few moments, stay tuned. B3 in Brazil, TP ICAP were all amongst those who were reporting their results during the course of the week in a mixed bunch of results overall, with nothing particularly spectacular apart from indeed those TMX numbers, which were a record for the Canadian market operator. During the history of Exchange Invest, we've had much, much coverage of the Indian subcontinent, and one of those stories which festered over the course of recent times has been the issue of the Nifty licensing. The Nifty 50, one of the leading Indian stock exchange licenses. At one point in time, through, well, what seemed to be manipulative regulatory fiat, the Singapore Exchange suddenly found itself with a rather worthless contract to trade those markets in Singapore. As a result, there's been a huge and ongoing battle. As the Live Mint headline put it, NSE and SGX have decided to bury the hatchet. They're going to create a new trading platform that is going to be located in Gift City. Gift City being the Prime Minister's wondrous, well, gift to his own home area. By opening up as they have, so far there's been a bit of a problem with content and generally a wariness of overseas investors to trust the idea of an Indian marketplace that is actually open for foreigners. That's the whole concept behind making Gift City much more open. Through a regulatory kerfuffle, therefore, engineered behind the scenes, presumably by various levels of mandarins, we end up with the interesting situation that now NSE and STX will operate a platform between them out of Gift City in order to trade the Nifty derivatives products. That's going to make for a very, very interesting opportunity, quite clearly. And ultimately, well, what did STX do? I suppose they found the old Cymex Eurodollar deal and wrote in Nifty 50 across every page to achieve a coherent situation where the trading is now going to take place in the open to foreigners Gift City Financial Centre. But at the same time, all trades can be cleared at the CCP of customer choice. In other words, National Stock Exchange for those who are in India, or STX for those who prefer using the city-state's long-standing proven CCP. It was clear throughout the course of the last week we were moving well into high summer period. Nonetheless, we did manage to get a little bit of deal activity. The Intercontinental Exchange, they've agreed to acquire the Merrill Lynch Option Volatility Estimate, or MOVE Index as it's known, from, well, yes indeed, Bank of America Merrill Lynch, you guessed it. That's a very interesting, neat deal. It adds a bond varietal to the resource-rich veins of the IDC data that Intercontinental Exchange already control. It's essentially a VIX for bonds kind of product. Therefore, MOVE makes a great deal of sense within ICE and can, of course, be integrated semi-immediately by their experienced team. It's a useful little increment that costs the ICE, well, the equivalent of petty cash, and doesn't have to worry about, well, monopolies, mergers, antitrust, or any of those sorts of curious issues in order to go forward and close almost immediately. I mentioned earlier on Virtu and the curious case of, well, a pain in the antenna. Virtu have got spiky about the NYSE having rights to an exclusive aerial, it seems. In other words, the exchange fee fight is moving away from the NYSE floor to the rooftops of a particular data centre. In this case, of course, we're looking at Mahwa, the city which I suppose is known by more financial executives that none of them have visited. That's the place where the New York Stock Exchange, amongst other exchanges, have their low-latency data centres, where actually the vast bulk of trades are being processed in the US equity marketplace itself. So, the NYSE wants to install a microwave piece of equipment on the roof of its data centre to speed up data transmissions. That, according to Virtu Financial, is anti-competitive and could result in higher trading costs. They've complained to the SEC and said, well, it's just not fair. No signs of throwing their toys out of the pram quite yet, but obviously that can't necessarily be discounted. So, how does this play out? Well, if Virtu can successfully stop NYSE from being in charge of their data on a third-party commercial venue, albeit from its Mahui servers in the NYSE's cabinets, which it's renting through the third-party data company itself, and therefore is prevented from taking what is effectively arriving in its cabinets and therefore in its network, moving that to its floor or other networked elements, that strikes me as only a bit of a short-term move. Then surely NYSE will just be forced to buy its own data center and install the antenna on the roof of the data center that it owns, as is its right, and we're going to be back to square one. Yeah, I'm afraid this claim strikes me as rather opportunistic and tenuous from Virtu, certainly on an outline read. That said, I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to come because, of course, New York is bracing for a mega data fight. Thanks to it being summertime, ladies and gentlemen, we're able for once to drill down into an individual set of results from a listed company. It's obviously difficult to do so during the course of the year, but hey, it's midsummer, so that gives us a little bit of an opportunity. And of course, there are, what, some 50,000 or more listed public equities across the Exchange Invest universe. Anyway, it's fascinating to look at the second quarter numbers of Uber, the ride-hailing company, which has, well, tentacles pretty much all the way around the world. I have to say, I think there's a certain kudos in order for the latest Uber results. I mean, when you have more cash than Croesus, decluttering it Marie Kondo style is an interesting approach, even for a mega unicorn. To lose $5.2 billion in a quarter takes genuine organisation and devotion. In essence, think about that for a minute. Uber lost over $2.4 million per minute, 24/7, over the 90-day quarter. Or if you want to think about it in ride terms, essentially, you could have travelled half a mile in 1 minute in at least 20,000 Ubers simultaneously in leading American metro areas. Albeit, I suppose, if you try to get 20,000 Uber reservations simultaneously, the app struggles and you end up with surge pricing. But you get the gist, ladies and gentlemen. In essence, Uber lost $57.78 million per day during the quarter. That's about $2.4 and change million dollars per hour. It even accounts to being $40,123 per minute. Good grief, it's $669 per hour. Well, that certainly amounts to a very, very busy quarter indeed. And for those who are critics of capitalism, look at it this way. Somewhere out there, some people have provided the risk capital through public markets and indeed through a great deal of rounds in private markets to allow Uber to hemorrhage this money. The net result is a huge societal benefit. The rest of us are all getting cheap ride shares at a point in time when Uber is hemorrhaging money. Can it turn round? Who knows? They've got a huge amount of money in the bank, but they won't want to repeat many quarters like this. In regulation this week, only one major story that we're really going to talk about, apart, of course, from that Chinese deregulation that led this Exchange Invest Weekly bulletin. The SEC in the USA is proposing to modernize disclosures of business, legal proceedings, and risk factors under Regulation SK. Fascinating. In other words, what they're trying to do is break down the amount of stuff that you need in disclosures. Heretofore, therefore, without prejudice, I suppose we would all like to say that subject to Article 163.9 of the... Actually, that's exactly the problem, isn't it? I mean, currently, disclosures and prospectuses are simply not fit for investor purpose. They're a wonderful piece of gobbledygook if you happen to be a lawyer with a lot of time on your hands, or indeed, a lot of opportunity for chargeable time on your hands. But truly... the current disclosure network is a farce, whether it's in the European Union, which is a shambles, or the United States of America, which is equally a daft bureaucratic shambles. The information is not transparent. It is impossible for investors to find the information very easily. And instead, we massacre massive amounts of forestry every year to produce legal drivel. That's essentially what prospectuses are these days, 265 pages in some cases, certainly 100 pages at the absolute very minimum, of which the lawyers have basically got their hands on the vast bulk of it, and somewhere inside there's about 8 lines which actually tell you something about the company, what it does, and gives you some sort of an outlook on what's going on. Oh yes, of course, I know there are lots of lovely and nice pretty pictures of the board and people being industrious at the company. Well, that's fine, that's brochureware, let them have that. But really, seriously, do we need all this legalese rubbish? No, of course we don't. The SEC's move forward under Regulation SK is a welcome start, because currently, as I said before, disclosures and prospectuses are simply not fit for investor purpose. Any change is welcome, but a lot more work needs to be done to reduce the legal gobbledygook to something that is actually coherent and useful for transparent markets. In People News this week, one of the most beguiling stories actually emerged out of, well, various networks. I read it in the Honolulu Star Advertiser take a bow. That's the first time you've been featured in, well, 1,550-something episodes of Exchange Invest. So, what we're talking about here is meet the 11 ordinary 20-somethings with $250 billion riding on their lives. The truth is, they're not actually that ordinary in a certain sense. Well, at least not if you're a financial market structure nerd, like me. You see, a lot of these people, their names give it away. There's the grandchildren of Nathan Most, for example, the man who invented the ETF. And therein we find the key to this whole puzzle. These 11 ordinary 20-somethings are effectively the people who are behind the trust that is behind the original ETF of financial markets. In other words, the whole idea is longevity, the ultimate piece of yield curve extension, I suppose, that we can possibly find in relation to human life. And in that respect, this fund is going to manage to survive to the point where the longest lived of this group of 20-somethings actually manages to exist, which I suppose could actually be, well, quite easily something like 120 years if you've been listening to my other presentations in public. Fascinating altogether to read this story. A useful and intriguing and lovely uplifting read from the Honolulu Star Advertiser. In product news, the Hong Kong Exchange launched weekly options contracts. The Zhengzhou Commodity Exchange launched urea futures. That's a kind of fertilizer, just in case you didn't know. And in fact, CME also lists some of those kinds of futures too. There were stories in various news wires about America getting its own replacement to LIBOR, the Ameribor, that is presaging something that's going to be happening in the upcoming week, because AFX, the latest brainchild of that wondrous polyglot of financial markets, the man who is really genuinely the father of the modern financial futures industry, Professor Dr. Richard Sandor, he came up with the Ameribor benchmark, and it's going to start trading on the Cboe Futures Exchange on August the 16th. All the best to Doc Sandor and the team for that great launch of a very, very interesting product that relates to the core of the actual banking lending business. Meanwhile, over the Tokyo Commodity Exchange, they're launching electricity futures on September the 17th, while the UK markets watchdog, the FCA, pointed out something that will obviously be very popular with a certain group of 20-somethings at least. ETFs pose no threat to financial stability, they noted. Over at the CME, their crypto indices now include data for accumulating the settlement prices et al. From Gemini Exchange. Away from Virtu's complaints about their antenna in Mahua, the New York Stock Exchange is aiming to speed up trading with a core technological update. That was the biggest story in technology during the course of the last week. Well, the other major story we'll highlight today was an exclusive to Reuters. Turns out that after much discussion with the users, after much consideration of where volume goes, the London Metal Exchange, that wonderful subsidiary of the Hong Kong Exchanges Group, well, they're going to be doing something that seems quite counterintuitive. They're going to be expanding and extending their open outcry trade to boost volumes. Volumes jumped in a three-month trial when they previously tested expanding the use of the ring. And of course, don't forget, the good thing about the ring is that it's a multi-purpose facility. It doesn't require you to have a gazillion square footage of floor. Think about it, the old Life Exchange floor in London was, what, something like 40-something thousand square feet. What we're talking about is the LME maintains a ring, which, as I say, is multi-purpose, reused for every different product, and it's only, therefore, 4,000 square feet. Adds an interesting little peak of interest to the Moorgate area around the City of London. Be unique, they're adding and maximising their volume. And that, ladies and gentlemen, brings us to the end of this week's exciting global trip through the world of financial market infrastructure, the Exchange Invest Weekly Podcast. If you want to catch up Monday through Friday, don't forget you can subscribe to the Exchange Invest Daily Newsletter delivered to your inbox at a cost of only $200 per user year. Ideal reading for anybody in financial market structure, and indeed the daily read of all of the most influential leaders in the parish of exchanges. However, for the next week, we're not actually going to be publishing because it's the middle of summer and it's also Eid. That will give you, if you're suffering withdrawal symptoms from this podcast, a little bit of a wait until the 24th of August weekend when we will produce the next alpha version, which will be version 10 overall of this podcast series. In the meantime, if you're looking for something to listen to, why not catch up with some of the beta episodes? There are 5 of them stored on our podcast host that you can reach through all of the normal avenues of podcast distribution. My name is Patrick L. Young. Thank you very, very much for listening to this podcast. I wish you all a very happy midsummer. I'm off to go and complete a book right now, and in the meantime, I will be back on the 24th of August with the next Exchange Invest Weekly. Have a great week in markets. The Exchange Invest podcast is copyright Patrick L. Young. At the same time, there is information, copious information, it's a big data world after all, within this podcast. Please do not construe any of that information as specific investment advice. Please do your own due diligence when you look at any possible investment, and please, please, please consult with an investment advisor before you make any decisions. At the same time, we're not trying to encourage you to make any investments herein. We're simply trying to explain the wonderful world of the business of bourses so that it may be better understood by practitioners and any other interested parties throughout the world. Enjoy Exchange Invest. Please do so without taking any risks on our behalf. We're not advising you to invest. We're not investment advisors, and we are not trying to give you regulated investment advice. On that note, have a great week in markets. Thank you very much for listening to the Exchange Invest podcast, the exchange of information.